Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy, and my guest this week is Michael Hessian, who is an American lawyer and documentary filmmaker. Now, Michael recently made a documentary about his namesake, Reverend Brian Hessian, who was a cancer sufferer who also made films in the 1940s and 1950s. We also find out what it is about film noir and ambiguous endings that appeals to Michael, why nostalgia comprises history plus emotion. We find out what motivated Michael to enter the law, the influence of the Buddy Holly story when he was young. He talks about going to see the Jackson 5 on stage. Michael tells us what it is that triggers sad memories, why he considers life to be a marathon rather than a sprint. And in the final part of the interview, we find out what Michael's 13-year-old self would have thought about what he has achieved. So my guest this week is Michael Hessian. Join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Well, it's my absolute pleasure this morning to have Michael Hessian, and we met, it would have been about 18 months ago when you were making your documentary.
Yeah, I think that's about right, and it's been, we've stayed in touch since then. Yeah. It's been a great little friendship we developed.
Absolutely, and I think that, and you were very kind enough to interview me to talk about some of my work in religion and film, but it, because it was your namesake, so you're Michael Hessian, and there's somebody who's not related, but Brian Hessian. And it was a fascinating project in relation to how you ended up producing this documentary.
Yeah, so I Reverend Brian Hessian is an interesting character. I ran into him, like you said, I'm not related to him at all. I found him, actually, oddly enough, on eBay when I was looking for a Father's Day present for my father. And someone was selling a press cutting or a paper cutting of Brian Hessian's obituary. And it said Crusader Against Cancer. And I just found that to be a very interesting guy. And I said, well, maybe I'll reverse engineer this and see if what his deal is. And then I just ended up really deep diving into his background. And I learned of he was a cancer patient and really fought in the 50s and 60s, or in the 40s and 50s and up to his premature death in 1961. About the stigma of illness and so forth. But before that, he was a British priest, obviously, of the Church of England, and a filmmaker, and an innovative filmmaker in the 30s and 40s, and had some really kind of famous, or not famous, but infamous kind of tussles with the Church of England about how he presented the figure of Christ in his films and whether that was appropriate or not.
Yeah. So, and did you then find having... finished the documentary, did you learn more about him that you didn't know before? Did you find new avenues to explore, or did you find that some of those were dead ends?
There were a lot of dead ends, but almost everyone that I contacted was willing to speak with me. I had 24, 25 interviews from everyone from Brian Hessian's nephew, who shares my name, Michael Hessian, though he pronounces it differently than me, up to senior consultants at St. George's University of London to talk about cancer and those different kind of scientific things. So everyone was very receptive, with two or three exceptions of people who just thought I was weird and couldn't quite figure out what I was doing. But the reception was great, and it reignited my love for film noir and things like that that he was kind of a pioneer of.
Because I was fascinated when you first approached me, because I came across an article that was published in, it was either Sight and Sound or the Monthly Film Bulletin, way back in the 1940s.
Yeah.
And it was about the relationship between church and cinema. And I found a few analogies with what Scorsese was doing a few decades later, which is what we talked about in the documentary. But explain the film noir link. That's fascinating.
Well, you know, you look back at when he first started doing his first movie, when he started filming his first movies as opposed to kind of producing them, and they had very kind of dark look to them, and some of them were during World War II, so they were kind of gloomy. It just struck, when you look at movies later, some of the greater film noir movies, you see these similarities between them, and you think, well, if he had really followed this, you know, forward, where would it have gone? But I went back and I watched a bunch of old film noir movies on YouTube and just had a delight with it. So it really, really ignited. I mean, back when I was younger, I was very much into that cinema. element.
Yeah, and I got really excited when I was doing my PhD about 20 years ago, precisely because I was thinking, well, people often say, oh, well, when you go to the cinema, it's just escapist entertainment. It's, you know, we all go there for the happy ending. But of course, there's a whole body of films from the 40s onwards, which gave us this underside of American culture where the ending is often very bleak.
Yeah.
And I found that a really important way into this, to say, well, if you're going to have a discussion about what movies do to people, you know, rather than tar them all with the same brush, there needs to, you know, I mean, it's Polanski who famously changed the ending. Was it Robert Towne who wrote the script of Chinatown? And he was accused of, was it not so much the light at the end of the tunnel, but the tunnel at the end of the light as being a way to categorize what he did with Chinatown? And Polanski's rationale for that is, well, people are going to be forced afterwards to say, what was that all about? How can we change the world? What can we do to make things differently if they feel that the ending has disappointed them or tortured or challenged them in some way? The opposite, of course, is to say, well, oh, what a nice, neat ending. Phew, that's a relief. Well, we're all going to, you know, we go home and not have to think about it.
Yeah.
So it's more putting it on the audience to be able to say, how do we respond to this, rather than for the filmmaker almost to give us the ending, which we are in some sort of homogenous way supposed to simply take at face value and not be critical of.
Yeah, as a writer and a filmmaker, I do think that the storyteller should disappear, you know, so that it's just the artist, the audience and the filmmaker, the artist or what have you, and leaving endings either ambiguous or sad when I write a book or I make a film. I try and do that because life is ambiguous. And if I can think about these things, there's no reason to think that the audience can't think through them themselves and come to their own conclusions.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of a critical way that I've done my art.
No, because the most recent film that I saw yesterday at the cinema was called Mid-90s. Mm. And it was a kind of documentary film, but very much in the Larry Clark style of kids.
Yeah.
And I found it actually quite depressing to watch, because it's about a group of kind of misfits in the mid-90s, fatherless backgrounds, and they're just going skateboarding all day and taking risks and doing drugs and being very promiscuous. And I don't remember, you know, that my experience of the 90s was very different. But as I was watching that, it was, rather than think at the beginning, oh, hey, I'm studying nostalgia, this is a film that's set in the mid-90s. That's exactly the period when I sort of like came of age. I was at university and I was expecting to be quite excited by that. What I came away from that from was a real sense of alienation, a sense of malaise. So the film didn't take me where it pushed a few buttons that I wasn't comfortable being pushed. But it was a challenge to me to say, okay, well, what is it about my safe, secure background that in some way wasn't ready for, you know, what was going on around me? Because nostalgia can often lead us down all sorts of different paths. We sometimes think, oh, wasn't it great back then? It's like, well, clearly not.
So was that a British movie? Or
no, American. It was actually made by the actor. He was in Jonah Hill. He was in Scorsese's Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
And he would have been probably around the age in the mid-90s. I think he was born in 83. So the film, assuming it was set in 95, he would have been around the age of the protagonist in the film.
Interesting.
So I assumed it was autobiographical.
Mm.
Yeah, he wrote it as well as directed it.
Okay. All right, kind of a passion project for him, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting, but it raises an interesting question about nostalgia, which is, and I know it's something we've discussed or I've seen in your notes, is can you be nostalgic for something you're not happy about or has bad memories for it as well? But it made me think, what is exactly nostalgia? I don't consider myself to be a nostalgic person per se, but I do enjoy history. And so I was thinking a couple days ago when I was preparing for this and just kind of thinking about it, that one definition of it, and maybe you disagree with me, is nostalgia is really history plus emotion. You know, not just history plus happiness, but history plus emotion. And I'm not sure if that's the right definition or not. I didn't go to a dictionary and look it up.
No, and I think there has to be a sort of element of bitter and sweet conjoined, because the emotion is it can be a longing for something that happened that you want to rebuild. And it might be a relationship, it might be a person, it could be a place. So space and place seem to be very much juxtaposed in how we understand nostalgia. You know, is it the people from the place that we grew up in that we pine for? Is it do we want to literally rebuild that city?
Yeah.
Rebuild the America, whatever it might be. And I find it really interesting because mixed up with that is a sense of displacement, that we are looking back. This is the expectation anyway in you know, what people assume nostalgia is, that from the vantage point of today, we're looking back and thinking there's this dissonance from, you know, where we are now compared to where we were then. But I often wonder, and actually this has come out through some of the interviews, can you be nostalgic about things that didn't happen to you, but maybe that you wished had happened to you? In other words, can you think, maybe watching a film, Back to the Future would be a really obvious example, the whole what-if scenario, you know, well, that's not what happened to me, but look what I was missing out on at the time.
Yeah.
If only I'd met that person then rather than later, or maybe if I'd asked that person out, or maybe if I'd been a bit more audacious in my decision making, maybe my life would have taken a different path. And I think that is also, is that, so that sense of longing I think is very much there, but it takes a whole, it's very miscellaneous I think in terms of its brief.
Yeah, because I don't find myself nostalgic for times that I lived in. You know, I try and work very hard to be forward thinking and not regret decisions I've made and not even look back at it. But I find myself oddly yearning to be back at certain periods of times I wasn't in. Like, for example, the movie Gosford Park is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And so that takes place in 1932. And I think sometime between 1919 or 1918, when World War I, the Great War ended, and 1932, when before things started to get quite bad again, I think that if I could be rich, that would be quite a nice, you know, place to live when the empire is starting to fade a little bit in the UK. But there's just something kind of romantic about it.
Because there was that brilliant Woody Allen film, wasn't there, where he goes back to turn of the century America and he meets all these great writers. And I think F. Scott Fitzgerald is in there.
Oh.
And he effectively manages to sort of see, was it great in the early, you know, so it was sort of the jazz age.
Yeah.
And right. It was this sort of real, this sense of America being really exciting and
yeah.
and all the possibilities sort of post, I guess it would have been sort of probably just before the Depression, I suppose, really. So, sort of that question of what is the golden age?
Yeah.
But again, it's very sort of the world of intellectuals. And of course, the in the conceit of this film, it came out in 2011, I think it was. And it was, the name will come to me in a minute, but what was fascinating about that film was the way which it suggests that every night all these great writers of the day were all going to the same restaurants, and maybe they were, but, you know, so it was almost as though he had them all in front of him. And then, so there's some conceit where he then travels back to the present day, but every night, I think it's in a carriage, actually. If he gets into a carriage at a certain time in the evening, he's transported back to the 30s or the early 20s, and then he returns back again afterwards. And it was the last Woody Allen film where he won, I think he was nominated for Best Director as well. So it was, you know, the critics were really, you know, this was one of the recent Woody Allen films where it wasn't felt that he was just treading the same old territory.
Interesting, because I'll have to look that up, and I'd like, because I'm a big fan of Woody Allen, but there's a time when he did Crimes and Misdemeanors, Husbands and Wives, Deconstructing Harry, where that was his, you know, another era where he was great. And then the last few films, I was like, well, you've kind of, you know, treading water, you know, like as you say. But that sounds like an interesting premise for a movie, so I have not seen that one.
But this sort of idea of if you read these great novels or you love the poetry of a particular era, what would it be like to be there rather than to do it from the vantage point or the disadvantage point of, you know, 80 years on?
Yeah.
And I think that was a fascinating conceit, because, again, it's that sense of being nostalgic for somebody else's past or a past that's been filtered through the glamour of magazines and publications and indeed through education. And I think that's a fascinating conceit. And it's the same, you know, the scenario that how many school children are being put off for life by Shakespeare because they were forced to read at the age of 13 King Lear or Macbeth, which they weren't ready for. And then later in life, it's like, well, actually, they associate that with something very challenging in an age when it wasn't their go-to resource material. And in later life, sometimes you feel, well, actually, I can read this for pleasure. There's no one, I'm not doing this for an exam. There's no right or wrong answer. So I find this whole sort of idea of returning to something that you may not have been a participant in, and it may be somebody else's legacy, somebody else's history that you're caught up in. But it's often, perhaps, I suppose, the expectation in nostalgia is it's your own. It's often about making something right or doing something again that maybe you feel you've lost. That's that whole sort of quest for a prelapsarian age, I think, is what for me is bound up with the nostalgic trajectory.
Yeah. So I'll tell you an interesting story that I think falls within the nostalgia category. There's a band that I grew up with in the 90s called Neutral Milk Hotel. They're an American band. They're kind of independent and small, but they were a big part of my life back then. And they did an album which they kind of blew up called In the Aeroplane Over the Sea. And I just loved it. Never got to see them for whatever reasons. I was busy doing other things. And they broke up after the first album, or, you know, the lead singer kind of had a breakdown and just disappeared for 20 years. A book by Nick Hornsby, is that the guy who wrote?
Absolutely. Fever Pitch, yeah.
He did a book recently called Juliet Naked.
Yes.
Yes. I believe it's loosely based on the lead singer of Neutral Milk Hotel, Jeff Mangum, who just disappears and then comes back. And he did come back, you know, a few years ago when I was living in San Francisco. And it was the buzz above anybody who was with anybody who loved music that Jeff Mangum's coming back and he's touring. And so I went to go see him at the Fillmore West, which is a great venue in San Francisco. And we were all there, the whole audience, you know, just prepared to be raptured, you know, basically. And he comes out and he sings these songs exactly the same way that he sang them 20 plus years ago. And I found myself very sad by it. I thought, this guy hasn't changed in 20 years. He hasn't written new music. He is, you know, just hasn't really changed. And it didn't leave me feeling like, oh, I wish I would go back. It was that I wish he would have come with me and done new things and done new experiences and not just relied on these music from years ago. And you see a lot of bands doing that. The Pixies do it, Jane's Addiction does it, all these different bands that I grew up with when I was very young. And unlike some bands like Pearl Jam that continues to make music, playing a full album that was 25 years old makes me think, well, I can listen to that. You know, what are you doing now? So, and I remember there's a lyric, one of his songs is called Two-Headed Boy, and it talks about a circus or carnival element about a boy in a glass jar tapping to get out. And I had written a review about it because I was doing reviews back then. I said, it appeared to me that we were all looking at a two-headed boy in a glass jar that hasn't aged in 20 years. And I found that disappointing, actually. Yeah. I was looking forward to something new and different.
And I saw the film adaptation, which was actually filmed around here in Broadstairs, just a few miles away from where we are in Canterbury.
Yeah.
And it plays on that sense of you grow up with a particular artist, you fall in love with that artist, you listen to their music, you want to sell it to everybody else.
Right.
You want all your friends to listen to this because if it's had this impact on you, you want to disseminate that. I find that with radio programs sometimes, you almost want to say, listen to this. It's a slice of life. And other people might say, it's just not my thing. But when you then meet that artist 20 years on, and then you realise that you've perhaps evolved, maybe that you've grown up, you're no longer that 18-year-old that you know you where that they entered your life at a particular moment when you associate with your adolescence, and that maybe that you've grown up in a different way to themselves. What an interesting story that has, because are you in love with the earlier version of that person? If that person is so exciting and so that you relate to that person so much, is there a sense in which they're always gonna sort of, you know, you move with them? And I think it's that disconnect, and which comes out, as I recall, in Juliet Naked, that they're no longer on the same trajectory anymore.
Right.
And so how does that then affect the apprehension of that original piece of music from the 90s?
Right.
Because you can't listen to it now with the same sense of nostalgia, perhaps, because you've now got something in the present life which has distorted that particular image, that particular representation.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And it really strikes me, and I see it every now and again, I'm like, well, that's not what... Because in the end, this person who you've grown so close to through their music is some person you've never met before. You know, they're not who you think. It's only your perception that you find you're really longing for, you know.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about your background then, because obviously you're American.
I am,
You're now living in London. So there's obviously lots to fill in here. But, but it'd be great to hear your trajectory, how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Yeah, I'll just tell you real briefly. I was born in Manassas, Virginia, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. My father was an electrical engineer for IBM. And we moved down to Florida, the state, Southern Florida, when I was 6 years old. And I don't really have any memories of Virginia, you know, vague memories here and there. My memory really starts in Florida. And we lived there until I graduated high school in, or whatever you call it here. Yeah, I graduated 12th grade in the U.S. and went to undergrad in Boston, and went there for grad, got my bachelor's of science in political science. And then from there, I went to law school in New York and got my Juris Doctor, they call it, in the U.S. and practiced in New York for a couple years, and then had enough of that and moved to California. And in the meantime, I went back to Florida a little bit and got my license there. So I'm licensed in a few states to practice law. But throughout that, I maintained some creative endeavors, written a few books, and done some other creative things, because I went into the law because I had a very real passion for it, which started when I was 14 years old, thanks to Home Box Office. I saw a movie on HBO when I was, I looked it up last night before we came. It must have been in 1987, so I was 15, I guess, or 16. And it was about the Chicago Eight, which was a group of protesters in Chicago in the 1968 Democratic National Convention that were put on trial. And their lawyer was a guy named William Kunstler, who was a great inspiration to me. He was a criminal defense lawyer and a civil rights lawyer. And I thought, well, maybe that's who I want to be. And that same year, a movie called From the Hip came out with Judd Nelson of the Brat Pack, who plays kind of a super cool young lawyer, like kind of good looking and wearing these cool suits and very kind of rebellious. And I was like, yeah, I want to do that. And that's what I did, you know?
And it's interesting because I could see the connection, because on Facebook, I often put up a film that I saw, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and it's made an impression. I put up an image from The Firm, and you said you saw it at the same time. Because, in my case, the embarrassment, because I know I should keep it to myself, was that I chose to see Sliver instead of The Firm. And I kind of regret it. Well, of course, I would have done is seen both, but in those days, it was, you know, one or the other. I if you can't choose between two different things, well, you just see both of them. But The Firm, I wish I'd seen it at the cinema, because it's a great sort of pop point. Well, I'm not sure that's the word for it, but you know, John Grisham's novels,
it's very clean,
you know,
very beautiful,
really exciting in the sort of, you know, you kind of, you know, they're always played by these, as you say, you know, Tom Cruise or indeed with Julia Roberts in The Pelican Brief, but these sort of very young, thirsty sort of, you know, people who really want to, it's the right, they go into this because they have the right motive, or they go in with, like with Tom Cruise in The Firm, they want to make lots of money, but then afterwards they develop a conscience, and so they change. There's always a conversion story somewhere in
there, one way or the other, right?
One way or the other. But so is that very much part then of your background?
Yeah, I remember I saw The Firm. I think it was probably my first year in law school, or maybe my last year in undergrad. But it was another, like, that's who I want to be. I want to be the cool guy running from the mob or whatever it was. And the law turned out not to really be like that. But I was a defense attorney for a lot of years, a trial lawyer, and loved it, you know, and was able to kind of keep a balance between creative endeavors and the law. I'm in London now because my partner is at St. George's finishing up a surgical training program, and we have another year or so to go with that. But I love London. I don't really want to leave. I don't want to leave the UK. Yeah. And I think we'll end up being in both the US and the UK, splitting our time. And I can do, you know, to the extent I'll go back to the law, which I think I will at some point, I can kind of do that remotely and do it that way.
But in a way, that's the obvious question to ask you. When you flip between the two, or you draw on your experience of living in America, you're living in London now, what does that do to your apprehension of the country that you're no longer living in, but which obviously is in some respects still home to you? Does your experience of living in London make you feel in any way nostalgic for America, or do you sort of feel, actually, now that I have this new set of experiences, I'm not quite sure this is really where I belong anymore?
Yeah, it's an odd time in America. It's an odd time in the UK, for reasons that are not dissimilar. And so I miss some friends, you know. There are things that I miss about the U.S. I didn't expect to miss, like driving. I don't have a car here. Yeah. And, you know, I had a pretty nice car in the U.S. And getting out on a U.S., I don't know if you've been to the U.S. before.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, but they have very big highways that you can go pretty much as fast as you want. Yeah. And I miss that and some friends and family. But I can't say that I'm too – we're supposed to go back for a five-week placement to New York in the next couple of weeks. I can't say I'm too excited about it. I've really, you know, grown quite comfortable here. The history of the United Kingdom in this documentary that I made, I had the luxury of coming here to Kent. I went to Essex, went up to Wales and interviews, a bunch of different places on the train and seeing this beautiful, beautiful country, up and, it makes me not want to leave because of the historical element. You can stay in a hotel that's from the 1700s or the 1800s and people don't blink twice. Yeah. When I went up to Wales,
Hay and Wye.
We went there.
Right on the border, the book capital of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love just going through those books, those different bookstores. Yeah. But Michael Hessian, who I interviewed, who's the nephew of Brian Hessian, lives not far from there. So we ended up staying in a big old hotel where Johnny Depp stayed and all this stuff, and it was just beautiful. We don't really have that in America, so I do enjoy that. A lot of it's being torn down even in the UK now because it's you do have to make room for the modern, but I do love it. You know, coming into Kent here, you see some of these old ruins and stuff, and I really do love it. So I don't know that I to say I'm nostalgic about the U.S., I'm not even really looking forward to going back that much, though I know I will, and I'm an American, and I always will be, but right now I'm quite comfortable in the U.K. and kind of the outlook, though. I've been obviously watching your parliament debate over the last couple of days is very different than the way that it's done in the U.S., but it's just brilliant. I just enjoy it, the way that people can seem polite but be taking very serious digs at each other. You know,
there is a sense in which it feels well, and indeed some people like Bruce Forsyth, the late presenter and comedian, the dance hall sort of, you know, style entertainer, is somebody who always said that prime minister's questions was something that he watched because it was the source in a way of great comedy. Or in watching that, you know, he could the drama, the excitement of that was very analogous perhaps to being on the stage at the London Palladium and having to win over an audience because of, you know, the potential heckling and the sense that, you know, you could just as obviously the last thing a performer wants to do is to you know, die on stage in the same way in Parliament. It's the sense that, you know, careers can are burned sometimes by how somebody asks or the right question or doesn't answer the right question correctly at Prime Minister's question time.
And it's like an improv almost, you know, because you really do have to get it right every time, or these people will, from the back benches, as they call it, I guess, really kind of rip out at you. The politics in America is very impolite, you know, very openly impolite. But when it comes to being in the chambers, they don't have that kind of debate thing. That's all behind closed doors, so you don't get to see it. So it's an interesting distinction. Yeah. But
and then I think, I mean, it's easy to say, oh, we're living in interesting times, and the whole, you know, a week is a long time in politics. But what I feel at the moment is, because at the time that we're recording this, it's the week that Brexit was supposed to happen, but doesn't look. It's probably not going to happen now this week, but we don't know if it's going to happen at all, etc. But what I find really interesting is that we'll probably find in 5 or 10 years' time, when all the books are written by the politicians of today, who have been very loyal in some cases to their leaders, and they will at the moment go out to the media and support or endorse particular positions, and, you know, they'll be very loyal. But it'll be interesting to see, as happened after the Blair years, you know, politicians, then they start writing their autobiographies, and you realise that actually what was happening behind the scenes may be more in keeping with some of the speculation that we often used to read about in the media. So, you know, the sort of the briefings that people might be making to the press on a Sunday, and then what their official public state pronouncements were, that contrast, shall we say, perhaps then is somewhat dissolved, shall we say, to put it diplomatically, when they write their memoirs a few years later. But, you know, really, I mean, historians in the future are going to have an absolute, well, you know, it's just uncanny because of what's at stake.
Yeah, I can't imagine myself wanting to live in any other time. You know, I think people will look back at this time and say, truly, it was historic. You know, almost in the way that the Civil War time was historic in America. Yeah. I mean, the changes are going so rapidly and so quickly on all different kind of fronts, social and political, that I think people, I don't know if people will look back with nostalgia on us, depending on how they define that term, but certainly they will look back and study it in a way that not every generation gets, you know, and I think that, that will be how this.
But what it often does, though, isn't it? It brings out, I suppose, a sense of, you know, where you stand on something in a way that you can't sit on the fence. What this is bringing out is people's passions, and whatever you think, whatever side you're on, I think the great thing about this is the sense that this is really what democracy is about. And of course that's why MPs perhaps in the last week have been quite unhappy with the way that they feel they've almost been told, well, you know, you've been naughty because you have voted against the deal that the people have voted for. So it's almost like they're saying, well, hang on a minute, who's sovereign here? Is it Parliament? You know, do we vote with our consciences, or do we just sort of toe the party line? So what we see is a fascinating development. It actually happened even yesterday when the control of the Brexit process and the parliamentary process has been taken over by Parliament rather than by the executive. I mean, this is unprecedented. These are historic, unprecedented times.
Yeah. For one day, though, right? They're just taking over for one day. I didn't really understand that. When I first heard it, because I was watching, I was like, they're taking over Parliament? I don't even really understand what that meant, but they're taking over these indicative votes for a day, and I do get that. Yeah. For me as a lawyer, you know, I do have that training, and like I said, a deep love for the law. As long as they're following the rule of law, it may be unprecedented, but as long as it's legal and it's rule of law, I'm very comfortable with it. Yeah. People's passions can come in, but that's the idea of a system that allows passions to come in an orderly way. In America, we're seeing it much less orderly. You know, and we saw that in 2000, obviously, when it was uncertain who actually won the presidential election. And in my opinion, and like I said, you know, I'm very devoted to the rule of law, you went up to the Supreme Court and they made the Supreme Court of the United States and they made their decision. It came back down. And I wasn't happy, to be honest, about who won, but I thought the process worked. And so I didn't complain about it. Not a time I'm nostalgic for particularly, but it was hard times. Obviously just, you know, a year later we had September 11th, which changed a lot of things. Also not a time I'm nostalgic for, but I have to say I'm glad I was there. You know, it's something to live through and say, this is what the country was feeling. You know, it was actually a moment when we were united, which didn't last very long.
And I think it's also a period, without wishing to sound facile about it, but it's also, because it could so easily, the 2000 election could have gone another way, you almost sort of feel as though there was a different, almost like parallel time frame. I remember the Michael Moore documentary when he started by having various people in the Senate referring to Al Gore as Mr. President-elect, because they were still saying, well, you might still be the next president. And it's interesting because it's almost as though with everything that then has happened, and so much has happened, you know, just in the last decade and a half, and you mentioned September 11 and then the rise of Trump, I think for a lot of people, there is this sort of sense of, well, what if? You know, it's almost as though, well, is there a certain point we can go back to? And maybe if we had a different outcome back then, who knows what would have happened? It's wishful thinking, but it's almost as though those silly plot twists in films like Back to the Future that we all enjoy, but we all just see it's fantasy,
guilty pleasure,
kind of also has taken, you know, it has manifested itself in our public discourse. I mean, even to the point that in Parliament, we had a few years ago David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, berating the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, for almost sort of like being a politician from a different age or having values from the 1970s. And he was making lots of Back to the Future jokes. Mm. And I thought, well, you know, it's all very funny and very witty, but there's a bit more to it than that. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are almost feeling, you know, how do we get to where we are? How can we sort of go back to a particular point and say, can we go back to that? And can we have our way again and do things a bit differently?
Yeah.
And of course, it's in reality.
Yeah.
We may well find that everything would be exactly the same as it is now.
Yeah.
But that is, I think, also what is the linchpin for the nostalgia interviews as well.
Yeah.
Because everyone has that in their personal life, or we see it writ large on the political stage. Something where you can say, okay. And it's like Beatrice, I suppose, in Dante's work, is almost the sense of, you know, the lover who died, but who is his muse, the sort of person of, well, you know, what if she hadn't died? What if you know, in reality, maybe they wouldn't have been together forever. But in his imagination, she exerts a far more powerful sway over him than perhaps she might have done, but we'll never know.
Yeah.
Had she survived beyond childhood.
Where that, I mean, you speak of Dante, so I'm going to go much more lowbrow here, but there's the movie of the butterfly effect. I don't know if it's an American movie. It says, well, if you change even one thing, it goes in very bad ways. And not to say I was influenced particularly by that movie, but again, it's an effort I have to not have regrets and try not to think about, well, what if we'd done this differently? The reality is we didn't, and we are where we are now.
Yeah.
And the idea of looking backwards to learn, or even to feel good about, oh, well, I do remember, for me, it's music and films mostly that I think of. Like, that was a wonderful moment in my life that I will never relive, but I have it, And so I'm not sure if that's nostalgic, I'm not. It's an interesting word, it's an interesting word.
Are there particular things from when you were really young that you remember? Any particular childhood memories, things that you enjoyed doing as a child?
Yeah, I was never a sports kid. I was never good at it. My father was. He played college basketball. My brother was. But I wasn't. But my first real memory that focused the direction of my life was when my father took me to go see a movie, which was the Buddy Holly story. With Gary Busey.
Yes.
That had to have been 19... I looked that up, too. It had to be 1979. And so I was 8 years old or something like that. And it turned me on to music. And I think my father later came to regret it because I became quite rebellious. And I got into, The Doors and Jimi Hendrix and things like that. And, people who were not as clean cut as Buddy Holly. I spent several years, listening to just 50s music, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, those great, those great bands. And probably when I was 12 or 13, being very nostalgic, thinking I wanted to go back to that time. And now that I think about it, one more quick story, and then I'll go back to your, let you ask your questions. But I was in a restaurant with my father, my whole family in the small little town I grew up in. And we all listened to a radio station, Waxy 106, which was the oldies station. So you would listen to the 50s music on that radio station. And the DJ, Rick Shaw, who was a big fan, I was a big fan of, was at the restaurant. And so I pointed him out to my dad, and my dad went over and said, would you mind meeting my son? And he said, sure. And he was, this 12-year-old geeky kind of fat kid coming up to talk about 50s music. It was very odd to him because I even then I was very much into the details. And he said, would you like a poster? Because I have some and I'll sign one for you. And he did. And maybe my mom still has the poster, but the inscription was, the past was great, but the future is where it's at. And that always kind of affected me because I was like, that makes a lot of sense to me. So that was that's a childhood memory. And I got a guitar, and then spent a lot of my teenage years sitting in my room playing guitar. But good memories though.
Yeah, and your music is interesting. You said that you grew up with a lot of 50s music.
Yeah.
For me, the charts were hugely influential. That was the thing we all sort of, that was the currency in the playground.
Yeah.
Was that something that affected you in the same way contemporary music? Were there particular sort of ways of, in a pre-social media age, ways that you'd interact with your school friends? And it was often down to sort of, what do you think about this particular song, this particular artist?
Yeah. The charts were not something that affected me for very long. I had a short Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 period. I got to see the Jacksons live on the Victory Tour. So, I did that. That did affect me. But I went from 50s music to 60s and 70s music. Yeah. Didn't spend a lot of time with 80s music, except, in those earlier years, my brother was into Van Halen and AC/DC in the metal era. So because I admired him so much as my older brother, I listened to some of that. But I was always looking for the alternative. So early 1983, 1984, 1985, I started to get into U2, R.A.M., bands like that, that were more alternative. It sounds funny to say now, but in 1985, U2 and R.A.M. were not on the charts, or 84, when War came out, for example. In the U.S. at least, War was something that nobody had heard of, the band, the record by U2. So the charts weren't really something that influenced me, and I was kind of, even then I was, you know, just a rebel and like anti, you can't judge art, so their, you know, charts shouldn't matter. Yeah. But looking back at it, I think they do. I do think that they're a pretty good representation of what was going on.
Yeah.
But the charts in the UK are very different than the charts in the US. The music's very different. And it was hard to get British music in the US yeah. in the 80s. You'd have to, I mean, to get an import, it would cost you $20 even back then of a vinyl yeah. record. And so we didn't hear a lot of, like, I'm trying to think of some of the bands, but Erasure, you know, bands like that.
Duran Duran?
Duran Duran was very big in the U.S., so I did like them because the girls that I liked them. And back then when I was 13 or 14, in America at least, you shouldn't listen to Duran Duran because that's a girls band. Later on, I listened to those records, and I was like, why did I say they were a girls band? They're an amazing band. John Absolutely. Taylor's an amazing yeah. bass player. They were tight, you know, but when I was 13, that's not what you.
And you just made me think of that era when you, as soon as you mentioned those particular years, I think of say Foreigner, the band. And of course, what's interesting is I later discovered I think there were four members in the band. Two were British, and two were American. Yeah. So if they were in America, half the band were in a foreign country. If they're in Britain, the other half yeah. were in a foreign country. And interestingly, they had. I'm trying to think which way around was it. I think in America, their two biggest hits reached number two, Waiting for a Girl Like You and I Want to Know What Love Is. But in Britain, Waiting for a Girl Like You hit number two, but I Want to Know What Love Is was number one. But it was very interesting because for me, that was like with REO Speedwagon, very American sounding music.
It was, yeah.
And yet America, the influence of American artists, we had for like Phyllis Nelson, Move Closer, you know, even USA for Africa, We Are the World,
yeah.
you know, huge hits over yeah. here. They were both number ones. And Sister Sledge and Pointer Sisters. I mean, massively over here. But, yeah. but it's interesting, you know, how much of that then went the other way.
Yeah, yeah. I regret, you know, not listening to bands like Duran Duran yeah. back then. And though I don't regret not spending a lot of time in the Pointer Sisters.
Yeah.
yeah. But that was the era too of Beverly Hills Cop, where I think the yes. Pointer Sisters did some of that, or mm-hmm. they did you know, some of that more digital electrical music and stuff like yeah. that. But I did seek out British music, you know, and found some of it very, you know, I really liked it. But it was more, I don't know if I want to say electronic than U.S. music yeah. was, but that was my sense back then, that it was more yeah. keyboard era. Like, you know, Nick Rhodes from Duran Duran yeah. and those different bands. But then I liked Joy Division, yeah. you know, and that was a very British band, Absolutely. You know. Yeah. And then New Order, which came after them, and I very yeah. much enjoyed them too. So,
yeah.
But they weren't really on the pop charts in the U.S. I don't know if they were in the U.K., they were very, very hard to find those records, you know, yeah. that kind of stuff.
Yes, and I think that sort of old indie music was very big over here.
Yeah.
New Order, because Blue Monday was re-released in 1988.
Mm.
And it was, I think, a bigger hit then than it was when it first came out. And even to this day, I was at somebody's wedding in, it would have been 2006.
Mm.
And as soon as that came on the dance, you know, people were just running to the dance floor. Yeah. So again, you know, that's something you still hear it very much on the radio these days. But it's the sort of thing that perhaps became bigger in subsequent years than perhaps at the time it was, yeah. was perceived to be. Lots of artists have that sort of renaissance.
Makes me feel
suppose.
Redeemed yeah. that I liked them in the early years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. yeah. Although I just suddenly thought, because Van Halen, Jump, and didn't the Pointer Sisters have a hit called Jump? So peculiarly, there we are, from Van Halen to the Pointer Sisters, who we just found a weird bridge of all these different
six degrees of music.
Yeah. Right? we've done it. Right? yeah, so maybe they weren't that alternative after all. But what about other things? That I mean, I'm fascinated that you obviously went into law. Is that what was the inspiration for doing that? What sort of what inspired you to become a lawyer?
It was really William Kunstler. You know, it was William Kunstler. He was this great defender of those who weren't defended, and that's for some reason what I wanted to be. I wanted to be someone who defended people. So it never occurred to me to be really a transactional lawyer or a plaintiff's lawyer, somebody that I don't know if I wanted to go into criminal law, which I did a little bit of. I mostly did civil defense in the aviation industry, actually, oddly enough. But it was really a sense of justice. And I got that yeah. again from music. You know, if you yeah. look at John Lennon's, yeah. I was a big Beatle yeah. fan, and you look at John Lennon's, you know, post-Beatles stuff. There was a lot of protest stuff, and that really got me thinking. And U2 obviously was a protest band, and that got me thinking too. So all that stuff really evolved out of music and film. Those were really my passions, which is why when I was a lawyer, I still did those things.
So it was very much the case then that when you were studying, you, and it sounds like it was the case in what you said earlier about the firm, but you found that there was sort of a co-relationship between the two, that you were studying law, but you were also finding that film was very much something that gave you a sort of almost a sustenance to that. It sort of gave you something to, was it like a juxtaposition perhaps with the career that you're going for, that you'd watch a film and that sense of whether it was the anger or just the admiration that you had. It was a sort of, it sounds as though there was a co-relationship between popular culture and the profession that you were entering.
Yeah, I don't know that people look at it this way a lot, but to be a, in my opinion, to be a successful lawyer, practicing lawyer in the US at least, I'm sure it's true. I've worked with a bunch with British solicitors and barristers. You need to be a creative thinker. Yeah. You know, the arguments that you make need to be creative. If you're going to set precedents, you need to be creative. You need to be willing to say, I see that law is there. I don't agree with it. I'm going to fight against it. And again, you know, that's kind of the rebellious person that I am, said, whatever argument you, there's a famous line from a rebel without a cause, I guess. I go, what are you rebelling against? And James Dean says, what do you got? Yeah. You know, and I always felt that that's something that, that stuck with me. So I would, I didn't mind doing in New York, there was TV show. You could get your own TV show in New York on their public, service TV. And I had one. So I would do these very experimental, very weird kind of little mini films that I would put up on there. Under a pen name, which I still, I use a different version of it today. My first pen name was Billy Pilgrim, which is a character from a Kurt Vonnegut book, and then I ended up being sued, as a law student, got worried that he might sue me for copyright infringement, so I ended up changing the words around a little bit to make it a different name. But I've always found that the art that you call it, I don't know what art is, so I don't know if I'm an artist or not, but that it very much comes from the same place where my legal thinking comes from.
And I haven't quite got out of the mindset. When I was at school, there was always that sense of, oh, you got an exam coming up, so you must do a certain number of hours revision. And we'd always be comparing. This was a mistake, I think, in the school playground, was how many hours revision did you do yesterday? And if somebody had done more than you, you'd think, oh, I'm going to fail this exam, and you're going to do wonderfully. Because it never works like that. And at the time, there was always that feeling that I felt very uncomfortable. Guilty, maybe, that I would be listening to the charts on a Sunday and thinking, oh, I should have been studying. But it's interesting now, all these decades on, and I can see, something I couldn't see at the time, that rather than go for the binary, you either study or you work, or you enjoy your
play.
You play, exactly.
Yeah.
That it's interesting that the skill that, maybe skilled, maybe overblowing it, but in writing down the charts on the Sunday or something, what that did to my mindset, the way that helped me retain memories. So I'd be in an exam, and of course sometimes you'd be writing on something, but you'd be able to cultivate, or you'd be able to bring something out from a particular memory or something, based on what you were listening to or watching at the time.
Yeah.
So sometimes the music that you're listening to can sometimes contextualize a particular phenomenon, a particular event. And I realize now that it was precisely because I was doing all of those things. And of course, now I go to the cinema a lot. But I find that in my teaching, I'm able to draw on analogies and examples of films that I've seen. And in some cases, if the students have seen it as well, then we've got something in common. A good example actually would be, I was with my students a few weeks ago looking at Jesus films. And I said, who's seen The Greatest Story Ever Told? No one. Who has seen The Last Temptation of Christ? No one. I think that some of them had seen Monty Python's Life of Brian, and some of them had seen or had heard of but didn't want to see because of what they'd heard about it, The Passion of the Christ. But I realized that I'd potentially lost them if we had 2 hours to go. And I thought, well, I'm looking at Jesus films, but somehow I don't think they quite knew. They were there respectfully, because obviously it was on the curriculum. But I was thinking, this is interesting, they're religious studies students and we're talking about Jesus films. They had no interest in it. And then suddenly it hit me. I said, who has seen Bohemian Rhapsody? Suddenly they were like, yeah, we all saw that last night. What's going on? And immediately I had them, because that whole sense of, why would you make a documentary about somebody's life? Does it matter if you're not telling the historical record? What if you're embellishing it? Yeah. Does it change your apprehension of the film? Maybe it enhances it. Because I saw the critics' reviews of Bohemian Rhapsody, and some of them were saying, but the order was wrong, and maybe it's a bit hagiography, and it's about the band members and the sort of perhaps elevating themselves a little bit, or, you know, and who knows, because Freddie Mercury died almost 30 years ago. But what really struck me is that the thing that made Bohemian Rhapsody work was not the fidelity to historical episodes. It was the sense that something was washing over them, that there was something amazing going on, that there was something that emotionally they connected with. And it had nothing to do with the case of, you know, let's look at the biography and let's sort of make sure that everything appears in the order in which it should do. Nothing to do with that. And I think, therefore, when I drew the analogies with the different varieties of Jesus films, suddenly we found that Bohemian Rhapsody, especially with the tragic death and, you know, the what happens after the death and the way that somebody's put on a pedestal, I think that kind of resonated in a different sort of way. So that correlation of, you know, learning, teaching, going to the cinema, it's all part of the same melting pot.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy of taking a music biopic like that, which, you know, wasn't particularly accurate, to say, but neither was the Buddy Holly story, but it turned me on to learning about him and stayed with me my whole life. But analogizing that to a movie about Christ is very interesting, because they are biopics in a way. Passion of the Christ, which I saw in the theater in America the first day it came out, because there had been so much talk about it, and people were crying. It was really the very visceral emotions were brought up to the people. Bohemian Rhapsody didn't have that effect. I personally didn't really like it that much, because I remember Live Aid very vividly, and I remember Queen's performance. I was working at a gas station at the time, and I remember coming on and Freddie Mercury just a little TV, you know, you could watch it on, and they had MTV on this gas station that I was attending, and or petrol station, it just, that always stuck with me, and I loved it. And so when they did that big Live Aid thing at the end, I was like, I think it would have been a better picture if they'd shown the actual Freddie Mercury, for that
period. For me, I couldn't tell the difference, because I think it was such an, it really did evoke
shock for sure.
I was only 12 at the time of Live Aid, and I remember that performance and just sitting there. And also, I think it helped that I saw Bohemian Rhapsody the first time at 12 o'clock. I don't normally go to the cinema on a Saturday lunchtime, but I did on this occasion. And because Live Aid started at 12 o'clock back in July 1985, suddenly watching this, and it kind of got, I know Queen came on at about 6 or 7 in the evening, but watching this being set up, and it, the film felt like it was, there's something very Saturday-ish about the film, and it suddenly took me back to my 12-year-old self, and I wasn't expecting the last 15-20 minutes just to be the set of Queen, almost in real time, and it was like being at a rock concert. And at the end, I which doesn't normally happen at the cinema, I wanted to get out of my seat. I wanted to clap. I wanted to applaud.
Yeah. I think my experience would have been different if I saw it in the theater. Yeah. I saw it on TV, so you don't get that big screen experience. But I'm told it was actually shot for shot. Like, it was precise, that there's a YouTube video you can go to that plays them next to each other, and it's literally shot for shot. Yeah. So I think in cinema, it probably would have been on a big screen, would have been a different experience. So.
Yeah. And what about other things at university? You mentioned film, politics, religion. I mean, I'm guessing that we've already covered all the incredible world events from the last sort of 15-20 years. Yeah. But all this was going on. You were at university in the early to mid 90s. I'm guessing.
That's right. Yeah. So I went to school in Boston and at Boston University. And so I was privileged to have Howard Zinn be one of my professors. Noam Chomsky would come in and talk to us. Elie Wiesel would teach us. I'm Jewish. I took a bunch of Judaic study courses, including courses on the Holocaust. And Elie Wiesel was one of my professors, as was Primo Levi. So it really got me thinking critically. And while I'm not anywhere near as liberal as Howard Zinn and people who are Zinn followers are, he taught me to think in a very critical way, to be quite skeptical of everything you read, and had a long-lasting effect on my life. And so I'm grateful for that, even though the People's History of America, I got a lot of problems. I'm skeptical of it, you know, just the way that he taught me to be, you know. So, and then that brought me back into, I was involved in politics early on, which I was a political science major. So when I was 13 or 14 years old, I stuffed envelopes for a guy named Lawton Chiles, who was governor of Florida at the time that I was there, and stayed active. The first time I voted was the first time I could after I turned 18. Voted for Bill Clinton, you know, and
so 92 was the 92 first election.
Was
yeah.
the first election I could do. I turned 18 in 89, I guess, but I could. Yeah, I yeah. just missed, you know, voting for George H.W. Bush yeah. or Dukakis, or yeah. I guess that was Dukakis.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But I was at BU, and during that election, Clinton versus Bush won.
Yeah.
And one of my professors was a guy named Tad Devine, who had been the campaign manager of Mike Dukakis and the campaign manager, I think, of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Or a senior advisor. I
very much know the name.
Yeah. And he said a really interesting thing, and this, I don't know if this is about nostalgia, but we'll get back to it. But he said, this was before the age of the internet, but he said, you have to read every day the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and like Wall Street Journal, six things. Read them all. Every page, you read the same story, but from different perspectives, and then you understand the story. And that really, really triggered the way that I thought about politics, saying just because someone writes something, you really need to see the way that other people write it to understand it.
Because I was really impressed by The Front Runner. Ironic name, because it was the film, I'm surprised actually it made it to the multiplex, and it was the film with Hugh Jackman, mm-hmm. and it was about the 1988 election, mm-hmm. and it was the candidate who almost became the Democrat. It was the chap who had to pull out because of adultery and, you know...
Gary Hart.
Gary Hart.
Yeah, Gary Hart.
And this was so interesting because he, in a sense, there was something very Clinton-esque about him, and yet he misunderstood the press.
He did. He invited them to follow him.
Yes. And then...
something Bill Clinton would never do.
And he was asked the question, and he was too honest, I think. He was asked the question, so would you have... This is filtered through the film, of course. But he's asked the question, do you consider adultery to be immoral? And he says, yeah, I do. Said, have you committed adultery? He said, I don't think I should have to answer that question. Oh dear, you know. So in a way, in a way, you've just answered the question. You've also buried your career, your potential career.
Yeah. I do remember Gary Hart, and I mean, I actually remember thinking that he shouldn't have dropped out, and I was disappointed he had.
Yeah.
But I was still too young to really understand politics at that point.
But the thing that I got, I mean, mostly this is through the films, I do remember I was only 15 in 1988. And I remember thinking that Jesse Jackson at one point was, you know, serious contender. And these were exciting times.
Yeah.
And I thought when I saw the film, The Front Runner, that it was said in that film, well, back in the 60s and 70s with people like John F. Kennedy, if they were misdemeanors, if they had skeletons in their closet, if they'd been sexual misdemeanors, whatever, kind of like the press would have just turned a blind eye to it, and yet move forward a couple of decades, and suddenly it was like, this is a big story.
Yeah.
And yet now you have Donald Trump, who, of course, in a way has had all sorts of allegations made against him, didn't stop him being elected. So I think you're right. And I think that's probably the filmmakers were quite deliberate on this. You know, what happened? There's something about what happened back in the late 80s then. A certain tide was turned, and have we now, you know, turned, you know, changed tide once more? But you know, what a fascinating thing when you've got somebody who seems to represent something that resonates with people's lives at a particular point, and then they fall off the radar, and you sort of just, you know, it's back to our sort of what-if scenario that we were covering earlier.
With those kind of characters like Gary Hart and you know, almost Rands, or, you know, things like that, you know, are very, I find them to be very compelling characters. And I see a lot of that going back to Reverend Hessian.
Yeah.
He was in a way. It's like, you know, he was just near the cusp of really breaking into something. And in some ways he was pioneering, but in some ways he just didn't quite make it until he started writing books about cancer. Yeah. And then I think he did actually, you know, turn the tide on a lot of stigmas related to cancer. He's very successful in that regard.
Yeah.
But as a filmmaker, he never quite made it.
Yeah.
And those kind of characters intrigue me because I think there's something about their personality that you can really, the normal guy on the street can really relate to.
Yeah, because I used to be really excited about Scorsese, and I wonder if part of it, and my PhD was largely on his work, largely because at the time he'd never won an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
And when he finally did win an Oscar, somehow he became not much less interesting. It was more like, well, he's finally achieved that. But suddenly then the challenge had been met. And that was surprising because I was so excited and I really wanted him to win. And maybe I want him to win for other films than necessarily The Departed. When he won, I was really excited. But then suddenly afterwards, it was almost something anticlimactic.
Yeah.
And I wonder, in the same way with here, you wouldn't have been interested, perhaps to the same degree, in studying Brian Hesse. And had he had a more, inverted commas, successful career?
I don't think I'd be interested at all. Yeah. Somebody else would have done it. It wouldn't have been some kind of mystery to uncover. And, you know, I went to Lambeth Palace archives and dug in and found all these great things and tracked down these people that knew him and knew of him. And it really was like a treasure hunt. And I had considered doing the documentary in kind of more of a Michael Moore manner, where I interject myself, which is the way that a lot of documentaries are done now, where it's the filmmaker kind of. But I find that narcissistic, you know, and I'm like, I'm going to do it the old-fashioned way. And whether that was the right decision or wrong decision, I wanted to stay out of it. Like I said, I don't really like taking pictures of myself anyway. I lost my thought on that, but you took me back because I didn't realize that Scorsese's first Oscar was The Departed, which is to me not his best movie at all. You know,
well, and what also was surprising is that Taxi Driver had a Best Picture, but not a Best Director nomination, and didn't. And I was also surprised with Paul Schrader, who got his first Oscar nomination this year. And what surprised me is that neither Taxi Driver nor Raging Bull had Best Screenplay nominations, and yet those screenplays seem to be incredibly powerful and momentous.
I think they were too edgy for the Oscar committee at that time. Maybe they would be too. I mean, Taxi Driver is a very edgy movie. I don't think it'd be made today. Yeah. You know, I don't know that Raging Bull would be made today. Yeah. The early 70s is another great film era that you know I would have liked to have been part of. But when you talk about nostalgia, you look back, well, it'd be great to be there in the early 70s and see these great movies being made and great music being made, but very turbulent times then, you know, and you know, a lot of just overt racism and sexism and things that when we talk about race and sex and gender today, it's still very insidious in the American culture and in the UK culture, as I've observed, but it's not overt like it was back then in a lot of ways. And so you don't necessarily want to go back to those times because you kind of forget about the bad parts, you know? Yeah.
No. And a few more philosophically based questions just to round up. Yeah. I think you've answered some of these already. Actually, you preempted my questions, but you know, are your memories predominantly positive?
That's a difficult question. Yeah, I would say probably not. You know, I didn't have a great relationship with my dad. You know, family was kind of tough. And so I was very happy to leave home at 17 and never really went back to live. You know, I went to Boston and New York and California and, you know, all these interesting places. But I do have positive memories. But a lot of them were me sitting in my room. I was very introverted, listening to a record player and trying to play along to it and those kind of things, which when I look back, I think people look at them as kind of sad days, but they weren't. Those were my happiest memories, were kind of being alone and reading a book or a comic book or something like that.
But I think that's another way of answering what we were saying earlier about what's going on at the moment with Brexit, that these are tumultuous times, but people will look back and just think, oh my goodness me, you know, to have been there, to have been a member of Parliament, to have been a journalist, a lobbyist.
Yeah.
And I think also in the same way that sometimes when, I remember the 1997 general election over here, when a lot of people were really so excited when the Conservatives lost power. I'd only ever known a Conservative government. I mean, I was only about five when Margaret Thatcher was elected. Mm. And then, so people were really excited and were celebrating in 97. But then afterwards, I think there's a sense of, oh, it's all a bit dull and boring now. And suddenly all these people that you love to hate were no longer there.
Yeah.
And I think, and you even had impressionists almost like saying, oh dear, you know, some of those exciting, those love to hate people are no longer there.
Yeah.
And I think suddenly people will probably realise that they needed that sense. And what you were saying about particular types of music, or, you know, it may not have been happy times, but there was something in that your own, you know, your own stamp of your personality almost could be felt there, that you could almost affirm your sense of who you were because of the sense around you, the pervading sense of this wasn't you, or this is not how you wanted to be defined.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, there are some things that trigger sad memories, mostly not. But for example, the song "The Heat Is You Belong to the City" by Glenn Frey, which was not really one of my favorite songs, but it was a song that was during that time period. It, whenever I hear it, I have to turn it off because it creates a sadness in me that I don't know where it comes from. And you know, there's other songs like that too, or movies I see that I'm like, something must have happened that to me or that I participated in that was very sad at the time. I don't remember the memory, but I remember the feeling.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And would you say that you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, or indeed do you still entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life that may be in keeping with what happened when you were young?
Yeah, I think that I fulfilled some dreams. I'm still fulfilling others. Some I've given up on. Some I gave up on and resurrected. But I haven't forgotten them, you know. And so life is a marathon, you know. It's not a sprint. And so, yeah, I think, and I do this a lot, I think that 13-year-old Mikey would look at me and say, you did all right, you know, not entirely. I think he'd be disappointed in me in some ways, but I think he said that you kept your integrity, mostly, not entirely.
And are you still in touch with friends from your past?
From middle school, which is grade 6 through 8 in the U.S., I've got friends that I've stuck with. Most of them have fallen to the wayside, but certainly from that age. College, for some reason, I don't have any friends, you know, undergrad, but law school, I do.
Yeah.
But my oldest friends date back to 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade. Yeah, because we were in what was called gifted back then, so it was kind of, you took a test and you get into these kind of higher classes, and so they were smaller classes, and so you're able to get closer with some of the people that you were studying with. There's a few of them that I stuck with, though. My 30th year reunion is coming up soon for high school, and I've never been to a reunion, and I don't plan to go because I figure the people I want to be friends with, I'm still friends with.
Well, I went to my first reunion just last year at my university reunion, but there weren't very many. In fact, there were very few who were there from my vintage, shall we say, because many of the people who were there were students from the 1960s, the people who are now in their 60s or 70s. And so my own generation, you know, that we graduated actually 25 years ago in 1994, didn't really go. And I wonder, therefore, whether maybe in another decade or two, they will be more inclined to want to go. Maybe, but also because of Facebook, I think in a way we kind of have virtual reunions often daily.
Yeah,
to different degrees.
Facebook is interesting because for a while I was doing what everybody else did, which is that every high school person was friending you and you were friending them back, and I had hundreds of friends. And I realized I didn't stay in touch with them for a reason. We just don't have anything in common, and they might annoy me. Yeah. So I ended up for a while committing Facebook suicide, which is I went down to one friend, and then I slowly built back up again the people I cared about. And so now I have like 100 friends on Facebook, and they're all people that I could say I have some kind of actual relationship with, other than I went to school with them a long time ago. So it's a good, and it's a good way to stay, especially for someone like me who does travel a lot, both because of this and in my job. I traveled all over the world. Staying in touch with people you care about. Facebook's actually a good mechanism, though it can lead to political fights and stuff that, make it not so much fun, you know. So.
Absolutely, And my final question, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Yeah, we spoke about that a little bit before, but I do kind of pride myself on being forward thinking. I remember the past. I think it's important. History is different than my history, and I do love history. But I really think that it's just something we learn from, and how can we do things better or differently. So I think that I do think that, and it's one of the reasons I was attracted to the story of Reverend Brian Hessing, who I think was very forward looking, and his idea that film can assist religion and draw people towards it was something that was very forward looking, and that was one of the things that attracted me to his story. But I try not to have regrets. We all do, I suppose, but I try not to dwell on them. And I think it's important to look forward because there's so much, there's so many opportunities, people don't feel that way all the time. My best times are behind me. And as we get older and you realize that our life expectancy is getting much longer, and you have to think, well, I could be 90, I could live till 90 or 95 quite easily now. what do you want to do with those years? You know, you're not learning, you're not in school anymore, typically, you know, what do you want to do with those years? And it's a struggle for me because I've kind of got these two paths now. Do I want to focus exclusively on documentaries and writing and things like that? Or do I want to, go back and be full-time as a trial lawyer? I was actually in-house counsel, and so I was doing some interesting stuff for a while at a company that makes engines for airplanes. I suspect I'll probably do what I continue to do now, which is kind of do both of them. But I try not to look backwards. You know, people who have I want to make sure, yeah, but you know, have an honor wall with all their degrees on it or stuff. It's very prevalent in America. It's like that was a long time ago, and I try not to dwell on that stuff. You know, and just say, what can I accomplish going forward?
Yeah. Michael Hesham, so wonderful to catch up with you again.
Thank you very much. It was a delight. You.